I like hard poems whose words hurt. Plain counters dealt upon the board. Lines that stir a slumbering heat and shimmer of their own accord. And gentle poems that whisper wonder, that mock, caress and smile. A man bolt a heartfast window on joyful coasts of sail. I like dark poems, chants and spells, image-thick poems that conjure sway on the breast of heaving swells, poems that curse and pray. Belly laugh poems too that set us all a-quiver, that light and warm us through to a glow that's half a shiver. A poem is a breathing, bloodbeat, the creak of oars. It is a measured seething of ocean on our shores. A poem is an ancient thing, and always it beats time, while the words strain and sing, reverberate, ache and chime.
Welcome to The Study. I'm Craig Robertson, and that was the voice of Frank Calloway reading his poem Preferences. Poetry is something I've always found difficult to come to grips with. It's one of those things my education left me quite alienated from. I have groped my way to it over many years, probably through love of song, popular song, or just sheer love of words, of the beauty and power, the brilliance of the English language, and my own attempts at capturing a little of that magic in my writing. For many years now, I have read poetry with some consistency. I keep a volume or two on hand, and I always make sure I've got a solid one to take on a trip. In this program, we visit a poet in his study, Frank Calloway. Frank is a writer and also a painter. He's tackled novels and children's literature and once wrote a libretto for the composer George Dreyfus. But as you'll hear, we focus on poetry and how he got into it and how he works on it. Frank's natural habitat for a study was always in the bush, living under canvas, as he likes to put it. But it was midwinter when I sat in his makeshift study in the corner of a bedroom in Preston here in Melbourne.
What makes you happy? Well, it's a very important question. Making things makes me happy. Making poems, making pictures. And this is somehow connected with a love of fertility and abundance, which the things which excite me most about the natural world. And that's why when I work at writing poems, I don't really like to work inside. I like to work in the summer, of course, out under the trees. I wrote my best cycle of poems, Orpheus Looking and Singing, sitting under gum trees and at Wren's Flat, which is up on the Jameson River. Sitting in an easy chair in the bush. And I like to move around when I'm composing poems too. I like to go for a walk and compose a lot of it in the head and then scribble it down on the back of an envelope or whatever I happen to have on me.
Do you need to be alone to do this?
Pretty much. I know people like Keats wrote Poetry of Earth Is Never Dead. At a wild party, he was asked for a poem for a publication, and he left the revelling and wrote this sonnet, gave it to the bloke, and he took it away and published it. But I can't really work like that. I'm no genius. I have to go over and over and over and over the things I do, and I start off with given lines in my head and work from there.
Do you find it difficult to get that sort of setup where you can work?
Yes, I do. I don't work very well in this sort of an environment here where although it's handy to have a lot of books around if you want to look something up, which you do from time to time, but the looking up is a sort of excuse to stop thinking properly.
I've always found that half the job of writing is the logistical side, is just to get yourself into a position where you can actually work. It's difficult.
Yes, it is.
The social pressures and so forth.
Well, poetry is a bit different from writing prose. I think when I write novels, I write a lot of them. I don't want to talk about them at any length, but I just like to mention them in passing. Most of them are unpublished. I wrote one called A Kite's Dinner, one called No Hero, another one called Covered in Diamonds, apart from the two which were published, which were Straight Furrow and Bill's Break, and three extended narratives for children, Craig Spindle, Battle for an Eyes and The Quest for Golden Dawn. I spent a bit of time doing that, and I did find there that I needed to sit down at a typewriter and compose straight onto the typewriter. I needed to have reference books at hand much more so than with writing poetry. Writing poetry, it's different. I start from what they call adonai, which means some given lines. It's almost as though they're dictated to you by something from outside. You're not conscious of it being a willed utterance, and you work from that and gradually build the poem up around it. It may be the beginning of the poem, or it may end up coming in the middle, or it may even be a refrain line. And this is why the sort of ambulatory walking around or moving around seems to work well with it, but it wouldn't work well with prose.
You're saying there was nothing bookish about poetry when you first discovered it as a child.
Well, it was.
It seemed to have more of this physical, on-your-feet sort of feel about it.
Well, it didn't come out of... Well, it did come out of books, of course, but for me it was a treat to be allowed to sit up late at night and listen to my parents reading poetry to one another. It was my father, by the way, who really knew literature, not my mother. He knew enormous chunks of Shakespeare by heart and would recite them at the drop of a hat, sometimes at the dinner table. He was a very literate scientist. So, yes, it came to me as a treat to listen, and that it wasn't like reading a book at all. It was like further contact with my parents.
Yeah.
And it was oral and oral.
Yes, would the rhythm be important too, do you think? Or
very important, yes. You were going to ask me about John Cooper Powers.
Yes.
I corresponded with the old bloke. I suppose he's about the age I am now when I was corresponding with him. He once sent me a photograph of the lizard of North Wales, and he said something like, "Every day I try to become more and more like this lizard, sunning himself on the wall." That was a very important letter for me. I wrote a little poem about that, which I'd like to read you.
Yeah, okay.
Old necromancer, soothsayer and bard, John Cooper Powys, writer of magic tales, you sent me once, instead of a letter card, a picture of the lizard of North Wales. Across the back you'd scrawled, your eyes so weak you could scarcely see to write a note at all, "I try to become sleeping or awake, more like this lizard sunning on my wall." That spoke your life to me, lifted me up, where I could breathe beside you on your wall. And ever since, I too have worked that dodge, becoming fox or tree, river, ant heap, making my life flow out into a well, or perch in falcons on their nesting ledge. That seems to me to be central to my poetry. It was something I discovered through that note from John Cooper, but it was something which I'd, I'd sort of always lived with anyway. Yes, I've been heavily influenced by Alec Cope, who's another worshipper of fertility and abundance, which comes in mainly through sex and lovemaking in his poetry, but it's still virtually the same sort of thing. I was a student of his and became a friend, not a very close friend, but I used to go and see him whenever I went to Canberra, and he was always very encouraging about my tyro efforts. Gwen Howard too influenced me a lot, and I was a friend of his as well. I've read Blake off and on since I was a student, and Donne is another poet I've read and continue to read. But Shakespeare most of all. My parents used to... Shakespeare was the only really major poet that they... Well, that's not true. But he was certainly the greatest of the poets they read to one another, and they read the sonnets a good deal. And, as I say, my father knew not whole plays, but whole scenes out of plays. So from a very early age, I was steeped in Shakespeare, and I still go on reading him. Every year I try and get through all the plays again. I don't usually manage it. It generally takes me a couple of years.
At this point, Frank read his poem Preferences and went on to discuss metre and rhythm.
I like that.
What I'm saying at the end about... I'm talking about metre, not just rhythm. Now, in poetry there are two rhythms that run counterpoint to one another. There's the metre. A poem's an ancient thing, and always it beats time, while the words strain and sing reverberate, ache and charm. But you don't put the emphasis quite in those places when you say it naturally. You say, a poem's an ancient thing, and always it beats time, while the words strain and sing reverberate, ache and charm. So that you have two rhythms going at the one time in counterpoint. You have the basic metrical rhythm, and you have the voice-over rhythm going at the same time. And this is what makes poetry, it seems to me, this is what makes poetry different from prose. And this is why I don't believe in so-called free verse, because this only has one rhythm. Sometimes it's quite a subtle rhythm, but it's a voice-over rhythm only. There's no... They've deliberately cut out the underlying metrical structure, and in doing so, they've robbed the poem of any chance of counterpoint. And it seems to me that that's just throwing away the central resource of poetry. And I can't see most free verse as anything much better than chopped up prose. Well, I shouldn't say that derisively, because prose is very good. It's a wonderful medium, but it's a different medium. I don't like to get them confused, and I like to have a metrical basis.
You've written more love poems than most Australian poets.
Yes, I'd like to read you a couple.
Yeah.
I read one the other night, to tell you the truth. I'll read that first.
All right.
It's called Ask an Asian Girl. Once in New York in 1943, an Askenazi girl flew down to me. Hung in the air before my eyes, a slender flame. Ruth, Rachel, Leah, I don't recall her name. Though she came casual as the light of day, I found eventually she'd come to stay. A lioness she'd swallowed Cummings from the war before, and had him in her mind and gentle roar. She set and lit a hunter's fire in me that smouldered now for half a century. Once like a spark, so Cummings wrote, she said. Maybe he could still write when he was dead. When strangers meet, life begins, not rough, not smooth, not I, not you, not possible, only complete. I will go down laughing into the big dirt, and hold her coals to warm my flaming wort. And one more.
Which one's this, Frank?
This one's called Candid Grandeur.
Yeah.
I read that last one as a sort of curiosity because I wrote it at the age of 84. Candid Grandeur. Obsession is the word that tells my tale. One thought engulfs me as the sea the whale. One image anchors me as beam the nail. The starving man thinks only of a dinner. Thin bimbos always dream of getting thinner. Sky pilots harp on winning God a sinner. There are so many forms of odd fixation, trivial or base, or mere vain exaggeration, as well as sources of divine inflation. As misers are obsessed with glistening wealth, athletes and hypochondriacs with health, bird watchers, hunters, pickpockets with stealth, so, lady, my obsession is your face and body poised with such decisive grace, your image which now fills my inner space. To separate the parts is a fool game, as though to give a number or a name to teeth and claws might make the panther tame. And yet I need to try to limb you right. It is your essence burns upon my sight and blinds from time to time with its fierce light. I see you silhouetted, tall and slim, against the light, ready to ski or swim with power radiant in every limb. Yet it's your tenderness that moves me most, your bellflower tits so gently posed and belly curving in repose. Only the vision in your limpid eye appears to me with strength and symmetry to state the candid grandeur that you see.
We're in the study of Frank Kellaway, poet and painter. We continued our discussion of poetry and the life of the poet. Frank's father, Charles Kellaway, was a medical scientist who became director of the Walter and Eliza Hall Institute from 1923 to 1944 when he took up a high position in Britain. Frank spent some of his youth over there and moved in wide circles at all levels of Australian society.
Two of your collections that you've published have a little note, I'm not sure what you call it, at the start, a poem a day keeps the devil away.
Well,
do you still stick with that philosophy then?
You don't have to necessarily write one, but you need to read one.
So I presume writing and reading it then is really still central to your life.
Writing and reading?
Poetry.
Oh yes, yes, I read poems all the time.
At one point in your career you diverged into writing for opera or writing for music. I was wondering if you could talk a bit about poetry and music and your experience writing for opera. You collaborated with George Dreyfus.
Yes, it was very different. It was a sort of challenge of craftsmanship. It was a journeyman's job. George would say, right, I want a duet here, and it's got to be in 2/4 time, or it's got to be in waltz time, or it's got to be in whatever. I would go away and have to compose it in according to his requirements. That was all right. I enjoyed doing it very much, and I think it was useful. I think it helped my technique. I don't really regard any of that as real poetry. It was all right, and it was great fun to do.
I think you found Robert Graves' White Goddess an important book at least in at some stage in your life.
Very important for me here. And you're asking about Aboriginal mythology too.
Yes, well, that was sort of the next part of that question, yeah.
Yes. Well, I have included some Aboriginal... No, it's not true. I've included an Aboriginal myth in one poem of mine. It was interesting because it happened to be the myth about a nymph being trapped in a tree, mm-hmm. which is identical with the European myth which has exactly the same thing happening. I'm a sort of Jungian, I suppose, in some way, and I believe in the collective subconscious, and I think that whether you've read of it or not, and the stories of Icarus and Orpheus and all the mythical stories ring a bell and have an emotional response whether you know about them out of books or not. This is one of the reasons why it seems to me very useful for a poet to be able to draw on those in order to stir up certain sorts of emotion.
Well, one thing I found reading the poetry that didn't work for me was placing Orpheus or Eurydice or whoever in the Australian
setting,
yeah.
Well...
And this raises the issue of, you know, our relationship to nature and that sort of thing. So I'm just wondering on, you know, if you have a developed point of view about that or...
Yes, I'm very interested. I'd like to read you a poem of mine called The Miraculous Anachronism, because this touches on your questions on history, which I believe somehow in the interpenetration of the past and present, and the fact that things that are happening now have already happened and they're going to happen in the future as well. Now, I don't have any cyclical theory of history at all. I'll leave the theories to the philosophers, they can get on with that, but they're not for me. I have experienced that as a fact, and it comes very, very strongly in European painting, and I think it's relevant here to what you're talking about. This is why I set the story of Orpheus and Eurydice in the Australian bush. And this is about the Christian story. When Cimabue slept, he dreamed. He saw a cave, the mother resting and the child asleep. Watched the cows ruminate, but now it seemed rock turned to timber, and the steep entrance had grown a moulded architrave. He saw the past and future alternate. Now he is in the Christ child's dream. He sees the palms thrown down across an unfamiliar way, an unfamiliar crowd, an endless stream that celebrates his holiday. Stretch out to him their supplicating arms, fall in his path and call his name aloud. Now it goes on from scene to scene, but each is strange. Men speak in tongues he cannot understand and wear outlandish dress. Now heaven's queen goes sorrowing through a foreign land. Each time he looks at her, her features change, though constant in their joy or their distress. Each miracle, each mystery remains the same, and yet is acted out each time afresh. Its time is every time. This history, triumph of spirit and of flesh, changing in place, retains its inner flame, repeated everywhere, remains divine. The painter wakes, but still he dreams. He sees the flight, a Flemish girl, the baby in her arms. Through fields Spain has defiled, strange colour gleams on trees he knows, on scattered farms, and low Giotto's Mary, stern and bright, rides into Florence with her Tuscan child. I would certainly say that I have a religious point of view, although it's not a Christian point of view. I suppose I follow Goethe more closely than any other poet I know in this respect. And I'm reading Goethe again in the original with a crib. My German's not very good, but I read him with a crib. Yes, God in nature is one of the frequent themes.
The National Library interview, you said that we had a lack of imagination regarding God.
Yes, I think we do. The notion of God as a human in the first place, and then the notion of God as a male human, seems to me to be beyond contempt.
If such a thing does exist, what's our relationship with it, and where does art fit in? Do you think art, poetry, music, whatever, is about making a connection between us and that other order, perhaps? I mean, I don't want to try and prompt your point of view here, but I'm wondering how you see art fitting into that. Because one of the things that bothers me these days is that so much art, and I mean stuff on walls or whatever, seems to be about illustrating academic theories rather than whatever.
I know what you mean, yeah. No, I'm not interested in that sort of academic point of view. I mean, I think any of the arts have got to connect with our lives in one way or another, and I think they connect, for me, through this notion of happiness, which is why I wanted to start with that.
Sure.
This notion of joy in what we've been given, the wonderful, the abundance of nature and the variety of colour and shape and form and all those things.
If we do reject the notion of God, and I think I'm probably pretty much in the same frame of mind as you, but one thing that interests me is whether it's still possible to have any notion of the sacred. And I think of this particularly in the context of nature, and you know, whether there's anything in nature we can regard as sacred that people won't destroy it to make a dollar. Is it still possible to have any notion of the sacred, do you think?
I think it is, but the difficulty is that the word sacred is so loaded, it's very difficult to shear it of its associations with solemnity and church going and all that crap, which don't seem to me to be sacred at all. Yeah, sure, I'd agree. The times when I've felt awe and closeness to what I imagine may be some kind of spirit of creation has been in the bush. And because I don't believe in their God, it doesn't mean I don't believe in evil. I certainly believe that greed is evil.
Perhaps I could take that as a lead to something we've sort of bypassed here, and that's if we cast back to your youth. It's interesting to me the life you've led as an artist, or what we call lifestyle now, I suppose. A lot of people now would regard people like you and me as dropouts. That's not the way...
I'm being regarded as a dropout,
well,
too.
Yeah, well, it's not a derogatory... It wasn't a derogatory thing when I took that path either, and we didn't even know the word, but I guess bohemian... We knew the word bohemian, but I suppose the point I'm getting at is that in certain circles in Australian society and other places too, it was possible to take this path where... you know, you could mix with academics and then go off and work in the bush. In your case, you've worked as an orchardist and as an ab diver and an axeman and all sorts of things. Your wife, at least one of your wives was a classical musician, played with the Melbourne Symphony.
Yeah.
So that's a very interesting way to live, is to be able to move through all classes of society in a way because you're an artist. You're in pursuit of something else besides a conventional career. How do you feel about all that now, looking back on it?
Well, it wasn't certainly wasn't conscious. I mean, if you're an artist, you've got to find some way to live and make a buck to subsist on, and the ways of doing it are mostly pretty distasteful. Teaching was one of the things I did enjoy when I didn't have to have any contact with the administration, but I clashed with them all the time. Most of the work I enjoyed.
Look, for some people it's an ideal, you know. You have a social freedom, I suppose, that a lot of other people don't have. They don't get to mix in such wide circles.
I suppose I was a bit, when I was a communist,
there was a lot of hostility about bourgeois values and the bourgeois lifestyle, wasn't there?
Yes, that's true. And I'm sure I was influenced by that. The fact that my wife was a musician and second wife was a historian, she played the piano, and most of my friends were, not that I've ever had a very loud circle of friends, cycle, that's a good Freudian slip, but the fact that they were mostly middle class, mostly, but not by any means all, was due to the fact that I found it easier to talk to them and I had more things to talk to them about. My closest friend, however, was a chap called Bob Hamley, who was a builder and a furniture maker, and he'd been a fisherman in Bass Strait. He was wonderful company. He made you laugh all the time. He read books, all sorts of books, and could talk about them very intelligently.
It seems to me that it's probably a lot harder for people to lead that sort of life and do the sort of things that we did now. Maybe the work just isn't available, or I don't know. Their values are different.
Perhaps, I don't know. The values seem to be certainly different. There's much, much more emphasis on prosperity and owning things, and I'm sure that's true. Whether there are still any people around like... Well, I think Bob was pretty unusual in any time or place. Well, in Australia. I shouldn't say any time or place because I don't know about anything except Australia, really.
You're listening to The Study. I'm Craig Robertson, and we're visiting Frank Kellaway, poet. Frank and I talked a bit about his youth and the Depression. He also saw some active duty in the war in spite of a definite leaning to pacifism, and like many in those years, it radicalised his outlook.
But I was just seething with rage at everything that went on. And when Chifley brought out the troops against striking miners, I thought, well, that's the Labour Party, I don't want to have a bar of it. But I was an individual, knew nothing about politics, didn't know what to do. I had to join some organisation if I was going to make any impact at all. And the Communist Party was the only alternative that I could see anyway at the time. Didn't know anything about communism, and I joined it and served loyally for several years. Got beat up on street corners giving little lectures about things I didn't know anything about.
You got up and spoke?
I got up and bullshitted. Didn't know a bloody thing about it.
You're a braver man than I am.
Well, I don't think it's very brave. I think it was just foolish.
A poem that might be relevant to this was one you wrote in reply to Barry Dickens, which is actually, it's the first poem in The Mare's Nest, one of your collections.
Yes, I'll read this, or I'll read some of it. This is in reply to Barry Dickens, who was writing free verse, and so I replied to him in his own kind. I wouldn't really print this as a poem of mine nowadays. It does have some basic...
It does express some of this anger that you've...
Oh, it expresses some of the anger, but it does have some metric in it. in places, but it's too loose for my liking nowadays. Barry said, "Yesterday is dead." What I'm talking about is this syllable balancing between your teeth, the here and now. To say that what and where we're at is new and terrible is true but wearable, and somehow obvious, and somehow hardly matter for surprise. And it is also true that where we're at is where we've been before, and what we are is what we've been too long. That seems to me the point. Since you use capitals to shout, I'll do it too. Jackhammer, battering ram, the rack, napalm, gas chambers, bastinado, inquisition, pollution, stake, the electric chair, and who hunts witches now and then and always. Castration, sterilization of all non-Aryans, crucifixion, human sacrifice, the living heart ripped out and eaten, keel hauling, cat o' nine tails, relishing long pig, child labour in the mines and mills, trial by fire and water, and so on. I'd like to say a little bit about poetry. First of all, poetry should be memorable. We use it as a mnemonic, is that the right word? All the time, you know, April, June and November. 30 days that September rather, April, June and November. And the rules of the road at sea, green to green and red to red, perfect safety, go ahead. This is one of the reasons for rhyme, but I also think rhyme should be used structurally to make the poem hold together as a structure. I think promiscuous rhyming, rhymes coming all over the place at unexpected intervals is very destructive and not useful at all. And the third thing about poetry is that it's a sort of ritual. It's been used from time immemorial in chants and psalms and hymns and all those sorts of things, charms, riddles, all those sorts of things where there's a sense of mystery, and somehow poetry seems to be the right place to incorporate those things. And this is why I will sometimes spend a long time over a single poem reading it again and again and again in order to try and understand it. Sometimes it's not worthwhile, and the bloke who's been writing it just hasn't bothered to make any connections that a reasonable intelligence can get. But often it is worthwhile because the sense of mysteries is there and it's embodied in what's very difficult to understand. Discovering what it does mean is often like a sudden switching on of a light, and it gives you very great pleasure. I think that in connection with what I said about meter and speech rhythms is really the basis of what I'm on about when I'm trying to write poems. The landscape painter, which I dedicated to Manning Clark in gratitude. At a vanishing point, he almost vanishes. The great eye focuses, sees nothing where he's standing, only a window where space begins and finishes, a window revolving in his understanding. Watching geometries, the falcon traces, parabolas, arches, Ariadne's clue, it's all around, whichever way he faces. Written on air, trajectories are true. He's a sorry fiddler and dancer who twists and turns the tensions of the light to trap the shadow of a leaf or two. A would-be alchemist and necromancer. knowing the futile limits of his sight, for the great dome he paints a strip of blue. Bunjil, yesterday Bunjil the sky god passed me close. I felt his enormous pinions stroke the buoying cushions of wind that woke under him, near enough to blast me. Hung on the big air, he was free and blessed. But not today. I found him on his back, blood flecking his beak, his talons slack, though no down out of place on his king's chest. Abandoned, neatly folded, a feather toy under an apple box in the long grass. Shot because ewes were lambing here, I guess, and for the wool and mutton we destroy. Bunjil, though sacred to Apollo too, white man won't sacrifice a lamb to you. The poem called The Landscape Painter, and this is about the experience of painting landscapes. We have this convention that when we paint a landscape, it's as though we were looking through a window. We see it in a rectangle or a square. That's not at all the way we experience it in the bush, because we see it in front of us, and we see it out of the corners of our eyes, and we're aware of it overhead, the great arch of blue, and we're aware of it breathing down our neck from the back. I tried at one stage to introduce a new convention in which we weren't looking through a window at all, but we were looking at a circle. Around the edge of the circle was the horizon, with all the landmarks, and hills and trees, and in the middle was the arch of blue with the sun. And these were big pictures, 4 feet by 4, and I did half a dozen of them, and I thought that they weren't all equally successful. 2 or 3 of them I thought came out pretty well. I thought that, you know, if a real painter with some proper skills were to take up this convention and use it, we might have some more interesting landscapes. Well, there's such a fetish for originality nowadays that nobody would be seen dead using somebody else's idea. And after all, it's only a convention. They're using somebody else's idea anyway when they paint a picture that goes in a frame. These still went in a frame. Generally, I generally made it a square frame, because pictures hang on walls, and the structure of most of our houses is rectilinear, so that circles look a bit odd on them, although they can look all right. Anyway, I did most of mine were squares, with the landscape going into the corners, the circle in the middle with the sky.
Frank and I finished our discussion with him reading a few more of his poems.
79. Now in my 80th year, I wonder how the sleeping dolphins swim, and in a maze of dreaming, kelp and shells of every hue, dexter in shade, but sinister ablaze, navigate through. The wide-eyed lovers at the helm asleep, steam past the threatening reefs and shoals of lies, trusting shared bulkheads, shored against the deep, each taking sunsets in the other's eyes. Keep courses true. Still in the breathing dark, I wonder why, drawn by the heat of shimmer or shimmer of a flame, moths will leave petalled nectar cups and fly to play a singeing kamikaze game and die in pain. As in my 18th year, I wonder now at green blades shafting from a rotting course, viridian phoenixes from ash renew the shifting energies of the restless source which never ceases. This is a poem I wrote when I was going off to the war in 1941. I think it's not bad for a young bloke. I'll have no truck with gods of yours. Wrap my body in no Union Jack. Wail no holy prayers behind my back. I hate them all. Close the church doors against me. Never hound me in. Set up no block of stone, nor carve my name on any of your replicas of shame. But say that I died happy in my sin. If they do kill me or I die at war, then say I died because I have to die. Don't smirch my memory with a sickly lie, or say I knew what I was fighting for. Just say that pity moved me now and then, though I love truth, my belly and my pen. The Stranger in the Mirror. Barry Dowling said how all writers were ugly, and I'm inclined to agree with him. So I wrote this little poem about myself, The Stranger in a Mirror. From the blind glass, a stranger stares at me. A scribble of brown curls scattered with grey. And hiding in the grizzled beard, I see the lips like tender worms thrown up in clay. The purple nose pocked like a strawberry. A forehead slashed as though by waterways. The eyebrows are a mangy territory. Beneath the eyes, the skin forms two limp bays. Steady, cold blue and questioning, the eyes regard me as though I'm their property. I try to stare them out, or to surprise some telltale sign of their identity. But though I strive to hold them in my sway, always I must be first to look away. This is the most recent poem. It's called No Eulogies, Please. Let there be no lies, and let silence keep joyful decorum where my ashes sleep. Funeral orations never were the way, feeble grandiloquizing of the clay, to praise creation or enhance the day. The trendy eulogy I beg omit, po-faced and eloquent with wit. Just fill your glasses up and drink a toast, wordlessly, to my wordless laughing ghost. Suck in new life as from a honeycomb, but dodge the booze buggy if driving home. Thank you.
study, I'm inclined to ponder the relationship between the arts. Music, poetry, painting, theatre and dance and so forth are all very different animals. They all feed off each other, but it seems to me that more practitioners of the arts feed more often at the tables of poetry and, of course, of music, which are related to each other in a way other arts are not. Music is central and number one for me, but it's also one of the factors that have led me to my interest in poetry, something to do with rhythm, the resonance of sound in words. These two arts seem so basic, but one has to remember theatre too was probably where all of them began. It's interesting how some people relate to poetry and some just don't get it. I read in Darwin's autobiography how he lamented the loss of his passion for poetry, and he had been devoted to Shakespeare, Wordsworth, Coleridge. His disciple Richard Dawkins wrote a book about his struggle with it. It's something that doesn't readily sit with scientific rationality, yet many scientists, being educated people, do have a taste for it, a knowledge of it. I think of famously J. Robert Oppenheimer, the father of the atomic bomb, who was prompted to quote the Bhagavad Gita about 1,000 suns. Now I am become death, the destroyer of worlds. This when he saw the bomb first explode. My personal journey with poetry is part of the way I live. My city, Melbourne, sort of specialises in grey, bleak afternoons when time seems stiff and glacial. One is more aware of them on weekends when, unless there's something on, or perhaps the football is done with, you've got a certain hunger in the soul. You've got to do something to get out of the house. I like to go to second-hand bookshops around town. I can spend an hour browsing them and walk in a park before I head home for the evening glass. In the shops, you can shuffle around and scan down the shelves. Your mind stretches out with a certain comfort amongst the dust. This is when I feel sane. Philosophy, science, literary criticism. I focus on poetry. I buy and then I read it when I walk. I've built up a nice little collection over some years among the heavyweights. I've got Horace, Marvel, Blake, Wordsworth, Keats, Dickinson, Yeats, and so on. The Love Poems of Karl Marx. That was a steal at $3. I suppose he should have stuck with that, or I suppose there would have been someone else like him anyway. And the Norton Anthology I bought new. I'm trying to grow a little collection of Chinese stuff too. But the largest section is the Australian. The chronology from Kendall onward is represented. I try to collect some of the publisher's series without being fanatical about it. There's Brennan and Slessor, the Jindy Warabacks, Hope and Wright, Harwood, Porter, Calloway, Wallace Crabbe, and Barry Hill too, notably a volume on William Buckley, a subject close to my heart, and numerous others. I keep reading and exploring and listening when I can. Let's finish with a final word from Frank Calloway.
Great Shark Thrush for Oliver Gasparini. So this is the answer. But what is the question? Gertrude Stein's dying words. Flute voices of the thrushes ripple and trill, so that a question's shaped in every tune. Silver inquiries falling from each bill, as though all truth resided in their tone. But what the questions are, we cannot know. Victorians claimed that they were lovers' pleas. Our century goes for territorial show and martial challenges blown through the trees. Yet to each song the answer is the same. The phrase comes back exactly as it went. Each note burns brightly with its own wild flame. The answer echoes fervour and intent. So all the day in shadow and in sun, question and answer still resound as one.
Frank Calloway's publications include the poetry collections Beanstalk from Contemporary Publications and Mare's Nest, published by Overland. Music in this program included Mendelssohn's Song Without Words, played by Ronald Farren-Price, plus our themes, the Bach Prelude, also from Ronald Farren-Price, and the Handel Suite, played by Elizabeth Anderson. And they're all from Move Records. Details are on the study website at www.thestudy.net.au. And so, until next time, it's shut the door and reading lamp only in the study.